Chapter 10 of Green Grey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This legamous recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. It will be a crisp, velvety Queensland morning in May. One of those mornings when, though fighting against irregular rainfall, middlemen and officialdom, you'll feel it's grand to be alive and amongst it all. You'll have returned to your little homestead after having delivered the morning's milk to the factory, and will be preparing to carry on where you had left off late the evening before, pulling your bit of corn, while round about the yard the dairy cows will still be camped, contentedly chewing at the cud. Dissimulating willy wagtails will be hopping and dancing about the backs of them, waltzing from their tails to their horns, and serenading them, even giving the unsophisticated, unsuspecting, surly old Jersey bull a turn at the same time, plucking and pinching beaks full of hair from their coats, and flying off to upholster their nests with the stolen goods. In the art of cheerful and barefaced purloining, the sweet, pretty little William has no equal in the feathered world. But you'll pay no attention as you pass him by. Before you reach the corn paddock, however, a string of polo players sporting white breeches and top boots, with polo sticks strapped behind their shoulders, each mounted on a good style of hack, and leading a pair of clipped, corn-fed ponies, all in the pink of condition, and looking hard and tough, and fit to play for an empire, will suddenly catch your eye. Then you'll stand and stare while your heart will go faster. Those polo men will pull up short out of a canter, a long, long canter it will have been too, and passing through your open gate in treble file will hail you loud and joyously by your Christian name, inquiring in chorus, "Why the devil ain't you getting ready to go in to see the match?" Great stars! Before you can get over your surprise and make answer, they'll be riding right up to you, asking, "Don't you play at all now, Dick? Have you given game up altogether?" "Darn me eyes! Why, it's the Philp boys!" you'll jerk out, grinning in happy recognition of them. And, failing to write you down, they'll draw in, gathering all around you, chuckling and laughing like the real sportsmen they are. Of course you'll know them, the three famous mountain riders who, since the time their father used to strap them to the saddle, have known no life other than that on the back of a horse, and with whom in days past you played polo and rode scores of miles and locomoted hundreds more to play it. You could hardly forget them. Ah, me, you'll be pleased to see those old mates again, even though on appearances they have done better than you in the world since you separated. And you'll notice they've scarcely grown a day older in the saddle, and they'll be just as pleased to see you. "Willie, Eddie, and Artie," you'll repeat proudly, almost inaudibly, as you look at their troop of ponies, greys, bays, and browns all over, and when one by one, while adjusting their reins, they'll reach down from the saddle to shake hands with you, the ponies will be champing the bits, stamping, swinging about in a half-right and left kind of fashion, crowding you, shoving you with shoulders and hindquarters, as if ready and eager to trample you in the dust of your own little homestead. But you won't be thinking of the law of self-preservation. Your blood will start tingling and your eyes dancing at sound of those voices and sight of the top-boots and spurs, bright stirrups and polo-sticks again. And when you gush impulsively, "Ghost! Wouldn't I like to be one of you going to have another smack at it?" you'll have said all that your heart will allow you at the moment. Then, when those mountain-reared brothers, filled with quiet gladness, will hope to see you playing with them again one day, and making those runs you used to make on Hippy, down the side and round the wings, putting in those near-side forward hits on her that used to paralyze those who tried to write you off, your memory will fly back to matches at Toowoomba, Spring Creek, Ipswich, Emu Creek, Brisbane, and other places, and your eyes will glimmer till the scene before you and the green sward beneath is a phantom polo ground with the dairy cow's portion of the spectators, and you yourself standing there booted and spurred, puffing and leaning on a polo stick. But on the boys asking, "Have you got a pair of shoeing pincers on the homestead, Dick?" you'll come quickly out of that daydream. "Yes, of course," you'll say with feelings of fresh pride, the pride of proprietorship. As the ponies swing round, you'll scurry across, leading the way to your blacksmith's shop, a flat-roofed bark shed, with two sarits and one end to it. The other end is its open door. Inside there'll be a forge with a small bellows installed, and other fittings. An anvil, a heap of old iron, a pile of miscellaneous horseshoes, tongs, hammers, hooks, broken swingle trees, scraps of wire, and greenhide, and a broken dray-shaft. You'll be proud of your blacksmith shop, too. Proud because you designed and built it yourself, and collected everything that is in it. And while the Philp boys are dismounting at the shop door, sorting out the ponies and fastening the reins of some of them, you'll be tossing tools about in search of the pincers and a hammer. "Which of them first?" you'll ask, brandishing a rasp as well as the pincers. But when on looking round you'll see one of the boys bent double with the grey pony's front foot held fast between his knees, at the same time motioning you to hand him the tools, you'll think of his snow-white riding-pans and the chances of their getting ripped by the nails, and him having to take the field, as you've had to do yourself times before, with a handkerchief tied round his leg to hide his shame. Then you'll ask him what he's up to, and bending beside him, you'll reach for the pony's foot and place it between your own knees. He'll stand by hitching at his belt and holding the halter-rein to keep the animal still for your benefit. Like a skilled craftsman, you'll handle the rasp and pincers, and in a minute or so you'll be lugging and twisting that shoe till you toss it aside. And when the others, looking on, will compliment you, you'll grin proudly and go on attending to the rest, putting the rasp on them and trimming their hoofs. You'll straighten up at the finish, perspiring, and with a pain in your back you'll move amongst those ponies, patting them, scrutinizing them, and asking about their breeding and the rest. And when the brothers, without discounting the merits of any, will assure you with enthusiasm that none of them ever was and never will be as good, or half as good, as the hippy mare you used to play on in the days gone by, your memory will fly back to her achievements, and to the thrills and triumphs you shared with her. "That little bay bloke there of Artie's beside you," one will suggest, indicating a pony on whose hindquarters you'll be leaning, "is something like Hippy was when you first played her, Dick." "Something," you'll agree. "A bit higher, perhaps, but hasn't her rein or chest." "He hasn't Hippy's face, either," another brother will supplement, as they all start collecting the ponies and gathering the reins together. "Nor her brains and gameness." Then, as all three reach the saddles, "Her sword, Dick, are few and far between." You won't say anything at the moment, for you can't help picturing the little mare in your mind, and thinking what a wonder she really was. One you had bred and reared and trained yourself, one that had carried you so often into the limelight, and a faithful companion to you in the saddle and out of it. And thoughts of her will stir feelings that will dim your eyes, till a further question or two will lift you out of your brief reverie. "She was out of a black-butt mare," you'll answer, "by young Olympic, a trotter on the Clifton side, if you remember." And as they gaze down on you, their eyes brimming with the light of fellowship of horse, while they adjust their halter-reins and fumble with neatly booted feet for the off-stirrup-irons, you'll go on to explain feelingly, as though you were speaking of a lost relation, that you had her for 2 or 3 years after leaving their part of the world and giving up the game. And, stroking the pony nearest you on his arched and glowing neck, you'll add, after a silence, "I took her with me on a big droving trip to the Cooper and across the Barclay, and just as she used to follow a polo ball, she would keep on the heels of a beast. A marvellous mare at cutting out on a camp. Gad, she was!" The others, shaking their heads approvingly as they sit erect in the saddles, will guess she would be. "She would never take up with other horses at night," you'll continue, "and no matter where it was or what sort of country we were going through, no Brumby mobs could entice her away with them. And the stallions at the head of some of those mobs running along the Colgoa and the Warrego were a daring, darn bad lot, too," the eldest brother, reminded of past adventures of his own, will put in. "No matter how dark the night was," you'll go on, "if I lifted my head from under the blanket and called out her name, or if I was mooching round quietly by myself, as you know a fellow does out there sometimes, or along with a mate, she'd whinny to me to let me know she was about, and if I didn't answer she'd come closer and whinny again. Great as she was at polo," you'll tell them, "I think she was even better after stock. The last time I rode her was after cattle over the dividing range, not many miles from here, on Mama Creek. After mustering most of the day on her, I was making back with young Gower, carrying a tomahawk that we'd found near an old saw-pit. "In a red cedar gully off the creek," one of them will suggest, and you'll nod in agreement. "And coming along under Tipsy Point," you'll proceed, "one of those long, herring-gutted, yellow-and-white goannas, not unlike 3 or 4 feet of centipede, about 100 yards on ahead of us, was scurrying for its life across our track, making for a big old-man gum-tree. There had been no rain for a good while, so the grass was pretty well eaten out and bare." Anticipating you, the boys will start chuckling. "Watch me head that cove before he reaches the tree," I said to Gower, and the darn goanna had only about 20 yards or so to go to reach it. But before Gower had time to grin, I touched Hippy with my heels, and off she went like a shotgun, and holding the tomahawk as a polo stick, I rode like a bushranger, making record reckonings of pace and distance. Gad, when the yellow crawler heard the rattle of her hoofs, he put the pace on, working his stumpy legs like machinery, and wriggling from his head to his tail. The brothers, leaning back in their saddles, will applaud the goanna in mirth, idly chorusing, "And who won, Dick?" "The darn yellow wriggler beat us for the tree by a yard, and was starting up it as Hippy flashed past, darn near putting her off front foot on his tail." "Remember the match we played against Spring Creek, Dick?" one in no hurry to go will ask with fervour. And slowly shaking your head and seeming to smile away back to the past, you'll stroke the coat of the flea-bitten grey before you in silent thought. "You won that match on Hippy for us, Dick, when you went right through the lot of them and got that last goal with an under-the-neck cut. A beauty it was. You'll remember it all. They had us walloped up to that. Marsden and Caswell were playing the game of their lives. Marsden, reckless as hell, riding across us and over us and on our heels." You'll chuckle, thinking of Marsden swinging out, wheeling at racing pace, swerving and riding off without ever pulling a rein. "We took you out of number 3 and put you up in the front," they'll remind you with gleaming eyes. And by the terrors, if Hippy didn't shake them up that day, nothing ever did. From side to side and end to end, she kept them riding after her like hell, and I don't think you missed a stroke, Dick. Darned if you did. Seeing them still smiling down on you, and making no signs of going, you'll find your voice again. Their mirth will broaden. "But do you know what a champion Hippy was at wheeling full gallop?" you'll continue. "Well, soon as she passed the tree, scattering dust and dead leaves over the goanna too, I brought her round in her stride, right on her haunches, and back she raced, taking the old gum on the opposite side, and as we flew past again, the tail of the dog-scared goanna was wriggling level with my shoulder, taking a pot-shot at it with the tommy. Darned if I didn't amputate it at the butt. The cleanest job you ever saw." The roars that will come from the polo men will start the ponies jumping. "And when I wheeled her again," he'll grin, "and looked up into the tree with Gower, there was our noble goanna, perched on the highest branch, and when he turned his eyes down on us, you never saw anyone look so darned indignant." As the mirth subsides, the brothers will inquire, "What did you do with Hippy, Dick? Sell her?" "In a way I did," you'll tell them. "I let Tom Allen have her for 20 quid, after she got in foul to a hairy-legged, wooden-headed draught-horse. Tom played her for a while, and then sold her for 100 to a cove who came along buying polo ponies for the Hordens. But I can't imagine city fellows doing any good on a mare like Hippy." Then in turn the Philp boys will reach down across their horses to bid you so long and shake hands warmly. And as you watch their mounted forms stringing out through your gateway, you'll live again in fancy those days when you, too, rode through mountain passes and over sunlit plains to line up and mark your men on the polo fields of the south and east of Queensland. End of chapter 10.